Noam Chomsky, MIT professor, is known the world over for his trenchant analysis of U.S. foreign policy and the media. For many, he is a symbol of resistance. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. He is in such demand as a speaker that he is booked years in advance. Wherever he goes, he draws huge overflow audiences, as he did on this occasion at Roxbury Community College in Boston.
If you want to find out what's going on in the world, there are a number of vantage points. A good one is to ask where the arms are, where the military forces are, the arms, the military training, and so on. Now, that happens to be an easy question for us to answer, because it's mostly here. You know, we have good information about it. It's one of the good things about the country is that it's unusually free in providing information, so we know what it's doing. By far, the biggest military forces in the world are in the United States. In fact, they overwhelm the rest of the world together. The flow of arms in the world is mostly from the United States, overwhelmingly from the United States. If we look where it's going, we can get a good sense of many of the important things happening in the world. So regularly, most of the arms flow is to Israel and to Egypt, secondarily to Egypt. That's in a category by itself. Same reason the U.S. military intervention forces for many years have been poised towards the same region. That has to do with the world's energy resources and making sure that they're controlled by U.S. energy corporations and accessible on terms that the masters of the U.S. economy want. So that's one category. If we take that, put that category aside and ask who's in the lead, well, in 1999, Colombia took first place. It moved into the lead in receiving the military aid and training from the United States. It had been the leading recipient of U.S. arms and training in the Western Hemisphere throughout the 1990s, for the last 10 years. It has also had the worst human rights record by far in the Western Hemisphere during these years. Actually, that correlation is one of the best correlations in contemporary history. For decades, there has been an extremely close correlation between U.S. military aid and torture and terror and massacre. If in any free society you'd be studying this in elementary school, certainly in college, it's a very important correlation that should be known and understood by the people who are paying for it, people like us. And the correlation remains, and it'll get worse. Colombia reached the peak, both in human rights violations and military aid, in 1999, went up this year. It's going to go up again next year. Unless we can stop it, it'll go up another $1 billion or more under Clinton's Colombia plan, shoot way in the lead. Who was in the lead before Colombia? That's interesting, too. In the lead before Colombia was Turkey. And military aid to Turkey tells you a story that helps explain why Colombia is now in the lead. Turkey is a U.S. ally and a strategic military ally and strategic outpost, so it's been getting a lot of U.S. military aid and trainings since the end of the Second World War. But it remained more or less steady until 1984. In 1984, it shot up. Military aid and training to Turkey went way up in 1984, stayed high, increased through the 1990s. It peaked in 1997. In 1997, Turkey got more military aid than in the entire period, 1950 to 1984. This had nothing to do with the Cold War. It has nothing to do with the Russians. They're, in fact, disappearing at this time. What it had to do with is that in 1984, the Turkish military launched a major counterinsurgency effort against the Kurds, 15 million people or so in southeastern Turkey who live under extreme conditions of repression. Just to give you an illustration, and it's a tiny footnote, a few days ago, eight newspaper editors were arrested in southeastern Turkey, the Kurdish areas, and are facing charges, several years in jail if they're convicted, for the crime of having, there's a Kurdish festival once a year, which in Kurdish is written N-E-V-R-O-Z, and they spelled it that way instead of spelling it N-E-W-R-O-Z, which is the way it would have been spelled in Turkish orthography. That's the crime. That's, as I say, a minuscule footnote, but an indication of the kind of conditions under which they live. So in 1984, the Turkish military launched a huge counterinsurgency campaign. U.S. military aid shot up. The atrocities peaked under Clinton in the 90s. As I say, 1997 was the peak year. The military aid went down in 1998, and Colombia took first place in 1999. Because the Turkish military campaign had pretty much succeeded. At the cost of 2 to 3 million refugees just in the 1990s, about 3,500 villages destroyed. For comparison, during the NATO bombing, 500 villages were destroyed in Kosovo, so seven times Kosovo under NATO bombing, tens of thousands of people killed, every kind of torture and monstrosity that you can think of, but it kind of worked. So the counterinsurgency campaign wound down. U.S. military aid and training was no longer needed. This is high-tech aid. This is jet planes, tanks, napalm, and so on. And therefore, Colombia could move into first place. Why? Well, because in Colombia, where most of the population lives under miserable conditions in a very rich, potentially quite rich country, more than half under the poverty line, there's constant resistance, oppression, massacre, torture, terror, and an insurgency, and that hasn't been put down yet. So therefore, U.S. military is shifting over there and is now in first place and is going up. That's, I think, the context in which to view what's going on. It's also intriguing to see the way this is viewed internally by the State Department and the press and so on. You may have seen a lead story in the New York Times a week or two ago about the latest State Department annual report on terrorism. And they listed half a dozen terrorist countries. The main one is Cuba and a few others. They also picked out a few countries for praise for their what they called their positive experience tough-minded counterterrorism measures. Turkey was in the lead there. They were praised for their positive experiences in having carried out some of the worst ethnic cleansing and atrocities of the 1990s. That was reported without comment. If Colombia succeeds in massacring enough people in the next couple of years, they'll probably be lauded for counterterrorism and the positive experiences, too. Turning to Colombia, it produces an annual record for years now of about roughly 3,000 killed in political killings, roughly 300,000 refugees a year. Again, horrifying massacres and atrocities detailed, described in considerable detail in human rights reports and church groups and Colombian human rights groups and so on. Those who manage to survive, many don't. The crimes have escalated in the last couple of years. In 1999, they were about 20% higher than 1998. They went up again. They're going up again this year. By early 1999, according to the Colombian human rights groups, there were about, according to the Colombian government human rights group, in fact, their own government, there was about one massacre a day in Colombia, about 80% of them attributed to the paramilitaries, who are very closely linked to the military. There have just been recent major reports on this, both by the United Nations and by Human Rights Watch. They're essentially the same organization. They're the ones who are going to be receiving the aid, therefore. And as I say, these are not just killings. These are brutal, vicious atrocities. The atrocities are mounting. The insurgency has not been put down. Accordingly, the military aid has to continue. The paramilitaries are primarily responsible as affiliates of the military, which is what they are. They're going to be picking up the aid. How did they figure? They must be certainly one of the major terrorist groups in the world, if not the leading terrorist group. They're certainly ranking very high. How did they appear in the State Department terrorism report? Well, they didn't. They weren't mentioned. However, there was a press conference given by the State Department, not reported, but was given. You can read about it in the Federal News Service. The State Department spokesman, Michael Sheehan, was asked by someone, what about the paramilitaries in Colombia, when he was reviewing terrorism around the world. And he said, well, we're considering that, but you have to understand that this is being that this being listed in the terrorism report requires a meticulous, scrupulous legal process. And we're really working on it. And if we find that there's any evidence that the Colombian paramilitaries are involved in terrorism, then you can be sure we'll put them there. In contrast, Cuba, which received 85 words in this 107-page report demonstrating its terrorist activities, that passes the State Department criteria. The spokesman was asked about that, too. And he said, well, the reason is that Cuba has not given up its links with terrorist groups, such as the Colombian guerrillas, the ones that we're attacking. So we can be sure that our government is vigilantly monitoring terrorism throughout the world when it's not trying to increase it. Colombia is regularly hailed as a leading democracy, and there's some truth to that. It had a power-sharing arrangement for the last 30 years between two parties, which are maybe about as different as the Democrats and the Republicans, maybe less so, and they share power. But as a democracy, it did allow another party. In 1985, it allowed an independent political party, which drew in some measure from the ranks, the constituencies of the major guerrilla organization, FARC guerrillas, and that was allowed to participate in the political system. It had a couple of problems. Within a few years, about 3,000 of its leading activists were assassinated, including presidential candidates, mayors, legislators, others had to flee the country. But it was allowed to participate, so it's a democratic country, and it deserves the plaudits we give it. The guerrillas drew their own conclusions about the options for participating in the political system. The U.S. government drew opposite conclusions. The Clinton administration was particularly impressed with President Gaviria, who was who was presiding over most of these atrocities. They described him as very forward-looking in helping developing democratic institutions under conditions of great danger, which was true. That didn't add that the danger was mostly due to his administration and our support for it. He was also, they said, forward-looking in carrying out economic reforms and helping integrate Colombia into the international economy. Know how to decode those words. And as a result of these forward-looking attitudes, the U.S. insisted that he be appointed Secretary General of the Organization of American States, as he was. This is a rich country. It's a country of enormous resources. Latin America is the area of the world that has the worst distribution of wealth anywhere, very high concentration of wealth and land ownership, enormous poverty in the midst of plenty of wealth. Colombia probably has the record in Latin America for inequality, for concentration of wealth, land ownership, massive poverty. It's gotten considerably worse in the last 10 or 20 years as a result of the so-called neoliberal policies, which have concentrated wealth even further, increased poverty and misery. As I say, it's now past over 50% living under the poverty line, which is extremely low. This has always, having nothing to do with drugs, long before there were drug issues, this has been the source of enormous violence. Peasant revolutions, massive terror and destruction. It's been going on for a long time, in fact, for 100 years. It got worse, much worse, in the early 1960s, changed radically. In the early 1960s, the U.S. moved in force under the Kennedy administration. This was part of Kennedy's general program, which was it focused a lot of attention in the administration on Latin America. And one of the most important things they did with a long-lasting effect was to shift the mission of the Latin American military, which is essentially controlled by the United States. So they shifted the mission of the military from hemispheric defense to internal security. Those are the technical words. Hemispheric defense was a holdover from the Second World War. And there was nobody to defend the hemisphere against except Washington, and that's not what they had in mind. So it was hemispheric defense was kind of just a cover for having big armies. Internal security is no joke, though, over. That means war against your own populations. The new policies and the new armaments that and training that went along with them, in fact, led to a major war against the populations of the Western Hemisphere from the Southern Cone in Chile and Argentina up to up to the Caribbean and Mexico. Terrible atrocities. They peaked in the 1980s with the wars in Central America, which you don't have to talk about. Colombia was one of the places targeted for these changes. In 1962, a U.S. military mission went to Colombia, headed by General Yarborough, a special forces general. And he gave advice to the Colombian military about how to deal with the internal problems they were having. The advice was to develop paramilitary and terrorist activities. Those are the terms of the report. Paramilitary and terrorist activities against known communist proponents. Well, the phrase known communist proponents means priests, nuns, human rights workers, journalists, anybody who's not supporting the brutal and miserable power system. They're known communist proponents, and they're to be targeted by paramilitary terrorist activities. This wasn't just advice. It went along with military missions, training, armaments, and in fact changed significantly the level of the modalities and the level of atrocities in Colombia, and turned it essentially into a war of terror, largely through paramilitary organizations against elements of the society which were trying to change these brutal and vicious socioeconomic conditions. And that leads us right up to the present. In the 1990s, it increased further. The military aid and training is going to go up again because it hasn't been completely successful. In the 1990s, Colombia moved to first rank among the terrorist states of Latin America. There were two reasons for that. One is that its own atrocities against its own population were, in fact, increasing. But the other reason is kind of like Turkey. The terrorist activities in the other countries had more or less succeeded, and therefore they were able to decline. In the 1980s, a couple hundred thousand people were massacred in Central America. There were probably millions of refugees and vast destruction, huge atrocities, all organized and directed and armed and by the United States. And it more or less worked. So the place is now quieter, kind of like southeastern Turkey, although there's a residue. The Jesuits in El Salvador, the surviving ones, many of them were murdered. But the ones who survived had a conference a couple of years ago in which they described what they reviewed the situation of the last 10 or 20 years of atrocities and pointed out that what remains is what they called a culture of terror, in which people's aspirations are domesticated with regard to alternatives different from those of the powerful. In other words, you lose hope. You get murdered and tortured and beaten enough, you essentially give up, and your aspirations are domesticated. Here, that's called peace, democracy, human rights, demonstration of our nobility, and so on and so forth. In Colombia, we haven't reached that happy stage yet, so it's necessary to move on with the punishment, to escalate the punishment until we can succeed in achieving a culture of terror in which aspirations are domesticated. Nobody should have any problems thinking of domestic analogs right here, incidentally. Well, without proceeding with the horrors in Colombia, what's it all about? There is an official story, the one you know. It has to do with the so-called drug war. That's not taken seriously by any competent analyst, and that's no exaggeration. And there's some very good reasons for it. One reason is that narco-trafficking is part of the elite culture in Colombia. The DEA, Drug Enforcement Agencies, had a major report about a year ago in which they pointed out that at every level of the Colombian government, there's full, direct and extensive involvement in narco-trafficking. That includes the military, up to their necks in it. It includes the paramilitaries. In fact, the paramilitaries have announced publicly that 70% of their funding comes from narco-trafficking. They're also drug producers. And remember, that's where the money is going, the anti-drug money. This, incidentally, is so extensive in Colombia that it reaches to the U.S. mission as well. The wife of Colonel Hyatt, who trains the Colombian counter-narcotics brigades. His wife was just arrested and I think jailed for bringing drugs into the United States, and he's just recently been announced that he's going to have to plead guilty on complicity charges. The sectors of the population to which the arms are going are up to their necks in narco trafficking, and that's by no means any secret. Furthermore, they're not being targeted. So although the paramilitaries are right in the middle of the narco trafficking system and are responsible for the overwhelming majority of the atrocities, up to 80% last year, if you can believe the Colombian government, they're not being targeted. That's not where the fighting is going to go, not to the territories that they control. And there's good reasons for that. They're basically the armies of the landowners, the narco traffickers, the oil companies, and so on and so forth. You don't go after them. Clinton's Colombia plan, is specifically directed against the areas that happen to be under guerrilla control, peasant areas under guerrilla control. The guerrillas, the FARC, are called, there's a term for them, they're called narco-guerrillas in the United States. Paramilitaries are not called that. Experts on the topic, including the United Nations Commission on the Scene or Colombian specialists in these topics, Ricardo Vargas is one, and others, point out that there's some truth to that. As the guerrillas themselves say, they tax coca production, but they tax everything. So everything that's produced in their areas, they tax, and since a lot of what's produced in their areas happens to be coca, they tax that. They have also been calling publicly for a long time for programs to develop alternative crops so that peasants won't be forced to produce coca. That's not part of the Colombia plan. Clinton's Colombia plan has a few dollars for out of the $1.7 billion for alternative crops, but excluding the guerrilla-controlled areas, so not a penny goes there for the alternative crops that the guerrillas and the peasants have been publicly requesting for years. No big secret about that. Incidentally, the Colombian government is also requesting it, but it's being disregarded. The U.S. insists on measures that even the Colombian government is opposed to, including experimental biological warfare programs and chemical warfare, which are now being carried out, and of course military operations. That's a U.S. program. It's not the Colombian program. They have to go along. They haven't got any choices. Why are the peasants producing coca? Well, that's well known. The areas where the coca is being produced, often the Amazon jungle, these are areas to which peasants were forced. They were driven off their lands by armies, paramilitary forces of the landowners, the narco traffickers, and others, who by now have taken over most of the productive land in Colombia, and the peasants are simply driven to marginal areas, like opening up new areas in the tropical Amazon. And there's not a lot you can do there. One of the few things that they can do is then survive, you try to survive, is to plant coca, for which there's a steady market. So that's one of the reasons. There are other reasons. Colombia was a wheat producer at one point. That ended in the 1950s. It ended in the 1950s because of a program that we're very proud of here called Food for Peace. Food for Peace is a program which compels U.S. taxpayers to pay U.S. agribusiness to flood poor countries with subsidized food, which drives out peasant producers, and provides what are called counterpart funds. Funds go to the government, which they usually spend for either enriching the rich or for the military forces so that they can kill the peasants who are driven off the land. That's called Food for Peace. The Food for Peace program in Colombia in the 1950s undermined and destroyed Colombian wheat production. So that's one reason why peasants don't produce wheat. There are, however, deeper reasons, and they're worth thinking about. They're very closely related to things going on in Seattle and Washington and on the front pages and so on. Back in the, as you know, in the 1950s and the 1960s, many countries were liberated from direct imperial rule. How liberated they were, you can ask, but at least they underwent a process of decolonization and they gained a degree of independence. By the 1960s, they were a strong enough force in the world so that their voices could be heard. Incidentally, that ended with the end of the Cold War. Perhaps the major effect of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War, was that it eliminated the possibilities for non-alignment, for independence, for the South, so-called South, the former colonial countries. As long as two gangsters were running the world, one global gangster and one regional gangster. It was possible, there was a certain space for independence. When the regional gangster disappeared and the global gangster runs the whole world, that's gone. And you can see it very clearly. So all sorts of indices. One index is foreign aid, which was never very high, but since 1990 has been declining everywhere. And in the United States, which has the worst record among the industrial countries, it's essentially disappeared. Another index, which is quite revealing, you just didn't hear about last month. The non-aligned countries had which represent, they account for about 80% of the population of the world. This is not a small group. They had two major meetings, one in Havana and one in Cartagena in Colombia, in which they came out with quite important statements, which were not published here. In fact, the Colombia meeting wasn't even mentioned. I had a friend do a database search on it. They came out with a strong condemnation of the neoliberal programs that are forcing them into poverty and suffering throughout the world. They came out very strongly against any form of sanctions, unilateral sanctions, and they strongly condemned what they called so-called humanitarian intervention, which is just a cloak for traditional imperialism in which the old imperial powers do what they feel like under a cloak of righteous moralism. Well, that's not the kind of thing you want to have on the front pages, so since it's only 80% of the world, we can forget about it. It wasn't reported. Well, that's part of what happened when the space for non-alignment disappeared. The interests of the South can be forgotten. They're of no concern anymore. Not that they were ever much concerned, but you had to worry about them when there were two superpowers around. In the 1960s, the non-aligned countries were strong enough to issue a call for what they called a new international economic order, a form of globalization, in other words. A form of globalization that would, as they described it, respond to the concerns and the needs of the overwhelming majority of the people of the world. And in fact, the United Nations, at that initiative, instituted its main economic planning and development unit, UNCTAD, UN Commission on Trade and Development, which technically still exists, but it's gone the way of every part of the United Nations that caters to some extent to the interests of the South, but essentially close to eliminated. It was formed in 1964 to develop programs for a form of global new international integration, what we call globalization, that would cater to the interests of most of the population of the world. Well, that wasn't going to go anywhere. A kind of globalization was instituted in the 1970s, but following a very different course and responding to very different interests. That's what's called globalization in the West. It's a form of international integration, which has at most incidental concern for 80% of the population of the world and has great concern for private corporate power and elite elements that are connected to it. That's what we call globalization. One part of globalization was a program to stabilize commodity prices. Now, for third world countries, for the countries of the South, which are mostly primary producers, that's extremely important. If commodity prices oscillate wildly, take coffee, which is the second major commodity in world trade after oil. If the price, and for Colombia, a huge product. If coffee prices go up and down very sharply, it doesn't affect agribusiness very much. So if you're a big agribusiness company, you can take a loss one year in your coffee production and make it up somewhere else. But suppose you're a small producer, suppose you're a peasant producer. You can't tell your children, don't bother eating next year, maybe there'll be some food the year after. That doesn't work. So if commodity prices oscillate wildly, it drives poor producers out of coffee production or other primary production. Notice that the stabilization programs are not at all unusual. Every rich country has them. The United States, for example, has massive programs of subsidy to mostly agribusiness to keep prices more or less stable within some range. It just reached a record last year of $25 billion, going up even higher this year. Same with the European Union, same with Canada. Every rich, powerful country has programs like this. But there's a kind of a law of economic history, which not many people are taught in economics courses, which is that economic development and growth depends very heavily on the massive state sector, which violates market principles, but in a very carefully calculated direction. It provides support for the rich and powerful, but those devices are not available to the great mass of the population, to the poor. They're not allowed to have them. And this was a case in point. So commodity stabilization programs paid for by taxpayers are fine for, say, agribusiness in the West, but they're not permitted for poor producers in the South. So the UNCTAD program to stabilize commodity prices was destroyed, with the immediate and understood consequence that it would drive poor people to produce something for which there is a stable market. And there is one. It's called coca, poppy, marijuana. So they're driven to that by these policies. That's gotten a lot worse in the last 10 or 20 years under our what's called globalization, the neoliberal policies. Countries of the South, you know, most of the world, are compelled to accept what are called rational economic programs, which means to open up their borders to imports from the rich countries. So to open the borders to highly subsidized agribusiness exports, which will, of course, wipe out their agricultural systems. That's happening all over the world, from Mexico down to the south of Latin America to Africa and so on. So you open your borders under what's ludicrously called free trade to imports from highly subsidized Western agribusiness. And then the peasants who are driven out of production as a result of this rationality are taught by people who studied at Harvard and places like that. They're taught that they're supposed to be what are called rational peasants. There's a whole theory of rational peasants. Rational peasants produce for agro-export, you know, not for the local markets, and they have to maximize profit. That makes you a rational peasant. Well, you know, if you're in Bolivia or Colombia or some such place and you want to be a rational peasant, there's exactly one way to do it, namely produce drugs, coca. And if you learn your lessons and you really are a rational peasant, you're rewarded. You're rewarded by chemical and biological warfare, by military gunships to kill your children and so on. That's the system under which we're now living. Being a rational peasant is part of accepting the logic of globalization that you hear great praise for. If you read, you know, Thomas Friedman and other cheerleaders and so on. Well, that's the rest of the story. And it's in that framework that drug production proceeds. There's a way to stop it. For example, you could allow commodity stabilization programs in the third world. You could provide a fraction of the money that's going for to kill people could be used to develop alternative crops. The socioeconomic problems in Colombia, which are extremely severe, can be dealt with in several different ways. One way is to try to change the internal structure of the country, to follow programs that would in fact benefit the population instead of oppressing them. That's one way. The other way is to go in and kill them. Well, that's the choice that you have, and you can see very clearly which one is being taken. There's a further question kind of lurking in the background, which I've never raised, but really ought to be. It's not a very profound question. And that is, what right do we have to do anything in Colombia? Try out new biological weapons, use chemicals in violation of manufacturers' prescriptions, go in with military gunships. What right do we have to do any of these things? And there's a cynical answer to that. The cynical answer is their governments asked us to. But if the governments hadn't asked us to, they wouldn't be their governments. So we can drop that argument. Putting that aside, what's our right? What right do we have to do it? Or to turn the question around, do they have the same right to do it to us? Like, let's just take, say, Colombia. Many more people die in Colombia from U.S. Lethal drugs than the number of people who die here from Colombian lethal drugs. And if you spread it over the whole world, it's orders of magnitude. I mean, millions and millions of people in Asia die from U.S.-produced lethal substances, as do many people here. I'm talking about tobacco primarily. The number of deaths from tobacco every year just in the United States is on the order of 400,000. The total number of deaths from all drugs, what are called drugs, is about 16,000. So it's like 25 times as much. If you look at the rest of the world, it's millions and tens of millions of people. Now, notice that those people, they don't have a choice. For example, if Thailand or China or South Korea or something were to try to prevent U.S. lethal substances from going into their country, they'd be smashed. There's a device called Super 301, trade sanctions, very severe trade sanctions can be will be imposed. In fact, they're constantly threatened if any effort is made to try to prevent the import of U.S. lethal substances. And that's a very severe threat for a country like, say, Thailand or even China, a big one, because the U.S. market is important. So you can compel countries to accept our lethal substances. Furthermore, they have to accept advertising for them. So if any of these countries try to prevent advertising, mostly directed at vulnerable populations, like, say, women and children primarily, if they try to prevent that, again, very severe trade sanctions. The result of this is that U.S. lethal substances are poured into the countries with massive advertising campaigns aimed at the most vulnerable populations, leading to a huge number of deaths, incalculable number of deaths. One epidemiologist at Oxford University estimated that of the current population of China, about 50 million are going to die from U.S. lethal substances in the coming years. So it's not small numbers. So then the question then arises, well, if we have a right to carry out these campaigns in Colombia, why don't they have a right to carry out chemical and biological warfare and military attacks, say, in North Carolina? It sounds like a simple question, and if the U.S. Air Force won't let them do it, why shouldn't honest American citizens do it? You know, because they can ask the same question. Well, I'll leave that question with you to think about. It's rather striking that it isn't asked. It's not a very profound question. You know, like it's not a question that any junior high school student would have difficulty understanding. But try to find the question raised somewhere. You can ask why. Notice that there is no debate about the character of U.S. lethal drugs. That's accepted. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court really recently determined, in fact unanimously, that tobacco is the leading public health hazard in the United States. It outweighs a huge number of others combined. And they virtually called on Congress to declare it illegal. They can't actually say so, but that's what it amounted to. Other questions arise, too. How many times recently have you heard about Delta Force raids on, U.S. chemical companies in New York or U.S. banks in New York or Boston and so on? If not, why not? It's well known that they're involved in narco-trafficking, heavily involved. In the 1980s, the CIA published a report, in fact, on chemical exports from the United States to Latin America, pointing out that they're way in excess of industrial needs and that the ones that are sent are the ones, the kind that are used for a production of drugs. So what about that? You know, nobody knows how much money goes into narco-trafficking, but it's supposed to be in the order of, you know, maybe $500 billion a year or something like that. It's estimated that over half of it passes through New York banks, U.S. banks. Well, that's not very hard to monitor. In fact, the Federal Reserve System is so well enough organized so that if any deposit of over $10,000 enters anywhere, it's registered. And that can be monitored. In fact, it was done at one point. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, when drug production was really picking up fast in Colombia, nothing like lethal substance production here, it's not a fraction of it, but was mounting, there was an operations. Federal prosecutors in Florida detected sharp increases in the deposits in Florida banks and began an operation called Operation Greenback to determine what it was, although of course everybody knew what it was, to find out what it was and to bring criminal charges against the people involved. Well, that operation was called off by the drug czar of the Reagan administration, a guy named George Bush, and that's the last time there was ever an attempt to look at that. There's much more to be said about this. Of the non-tobacco lethal substances, the one that's fastest growing, the sector that's growing most rapidly is the high-tech drugs, what are called ATS, stands for, I can never remember it, so I wrote it down, amphetamine-type stimulants. There's supposedly about 30 million people, addicts a year, that's more than heroin, cocaine combined. They're mostly produced here, and it's rapidly growing, so there are things we could do here. There's another point, and I'll end with this. This is enough to say that whatever's going on has nothing to do with drugs. You know, I mean, some other purpose, and I think it's obvious what the purpose is. But there's a final point to be made about that. It's well known how to deal with drug problems. It's not a small problem. I mean, substance abuse is a serious problem. The worst part is tobacco, the next is alcohol, and down below are lots of other drugs. And the way to deal with it is by prevention and treatment. Prevention, of course, means eliminating the social conditions out of which it arises, but just plain treatment. And it's effective. There are major studies which compare the effectiveness, government-funded studies, you know, major ones, that compare the effectiveness of treatment to other approaches. The major one by Rand Corporation compared treatment, prevention and treatment, just in terms of cost effectiveness, to criminal justice, what's called, I hate to use the word, what's called criminal justice in the United States, and it was about 7 times as effective treatment. They compared it with interdiction, it's about 11 times as effective. They compared it with what's called source country control, that's what we're doing in Colombia, it was 23 times as effective. So by substantial measures, these are much more effective ways of dealing with the substance abuse problem, which is a problem, you know, and you want to deal with it, that's the way to do it. There were some proposals from the Office of Budget Management and also from a couple of congressional representatives, Nancy Pelosi in California particularly, to put in amendments to the Columbia plan for small amounts of money for treatment. And they're killed. You know, that's not the idea. The idea isn't to use the cost-effective methods to treat the problem that exists. It's to kill peasants. And that's the plan that was passed. Well, for years, it's been pointed out by critics of these programs that they fail to meet their stated objectives. And that's true. They completely fail to meet their stated objectives. And that's recognized on all sides. So what do you decide when a program fails to meet the stated objectives? The methods are criminal prosecution at home and mass murder abroad. Well, what you do is you intensify the same efforts and you avoid the methods that you know to work. Well, you know, assuming everybody isn't totally insane, there's another conclusion to be drawn from this, and that is that they are meeting their objectives, not their stated objectives, but the real objectives. They're meeting them, and therefore you continue with them, and you don't carry out programs that would meet the stated objectives. What are the objectives? Well, you know, to make sure that social change of the wrong kind doesn't take place in countries like Colombia, and to get rid of the superfluous population in the United States. The United States is also being subjected to neoliberal structural adjustment programs. That's in Colombia, it leads to a class of people called disposable. In the United States, it leads to superfluous people, people who aren't making a significant contribution to wealth production and really aren't needed in what's called the new economy. So you toss them in jail. We're a civilized country, so instead of killing them, you toss them into jail. The jail population is shooting out of sight. In the last 20 years, it's become way beyond any industrial country. Any other industrial country has nothing whatsoever to do with crime. In fact, most of the people by now are what are called victimless crimes, possession, things like that. So domestic, in the foreign domains, it's clear what the consequences are. Domestically, it's basically a war directed against minorities and the poor, and it gets rid of them. And it has a secondary effect of terrifying everybody else. A lot of people are suffering from the neoliberal programs. So although small sectors of the population have gained from the rather tepid economic growth of the last 20 years, most of them are left out. And they got to be controlled too, and the best way to control people is by fear. That's every dictator, everyone else knows that. If you can frighten people, they're not going to cause too much problems. And the drug war is perfect for that. It makes people frightened, willing to accept authority and power, gets rid of people who are in your way, and provides a cover for the kinds of actions abroad that have been carried out for years under one or another pretext, but always the same. I think that's the framework in which it makes sense to think about and come to understand the Colombia plan. Is the aid going to Colombia high-interest loans, or is it real gifts? That's question one. What we're calling aid is I wouldn't call it a gift because it's a terror. I don't call jet planes gifts, but it's given to Colombia. It's paid for by the U.S. taxpayers. If you look at the lobbyists in Washington on the Colombia plan, you'll see where it's going to. The main lobbyists are military industry and the oil corporations. They're lobbying because they want American taxpayers to buy military helicopters, chemical weapons, biological weapons, send arms and so on to carry out actions in Colombia, which will be in their interest. So Colombia, they'll pay for it, but they'll pay for it in blood, not in dollars. That's the kind of aid that's being given. Aid is a bad word for it. The second question was, we should look at Colombia uniquely because of its unique properties, not in the context of places like, say, Turkey. I mean, I partially agree with that. Every place has its own specific problems. But we misunderstand what's going on in the world unless we see the patterns. Remember, we're not talking about the problems of Colombia, Turkey, Bolivia, and East Timor, and so on. We're talking mainly about the United States. These problems trace back here. And there are patterns that extend over time and over places. They're adapted to circumstances. Each country is individual. But I think it is extremely significant to notice that that military aid to Turkey, as I said, I'll repeat it, shot up, not because of the Cold War or anything else, but because of the need to suppress the domestic insurgency, which was a reaction to enormous repression. And that aid, so-called aid, declined when the insurgency was destroyed with extreme brutality, some of the worst brutality of the 1990s. And as it declined and moved from first place, Colombia moved into first place because it's facing the same problems. It has carried out the military and its paramilitary forces, aimed and trained by the U.S., have carried out immense atrocities. Like Colombia now has the largest internal refugee population in the world, outside of Sudan and Afghanistan, I think, third in the world. And the number of killings is enormous and going up. But it hasn't succeeded, so that's becoming in first place. And that's only pieces of a much bigger pattern. I mentioned Central America and others. And I think it makes good sense to look at the global patterns if we want to understand what's happening. But yes, I agree with you that we should look at the specifics of Colombia, and that's, in fact, most of what I talked about. As to the narco-traffickers being pervasive in Colombia, that's not exactly what I said. I quoted the Drug Enforcement Agency of the United States government, the leading agency concerned with drugs, which published a major report on this. And what it pointed out is that narco-trafficking is pervasive at every level of government in Colombia. Okay? That has nothing to do with whether Colombians are decent people. Sure, they are very decent people, but they're not at the highest levels of government. At the higher levels of government, it's just narco-trafficking is pervasive, including the military and including the paramilitary associates. Actually, for the first time, the main paramilitary leader, Carlos Castaño, appeared on television, if you're Colombian, you know this, appeared on television a couple of weeks ago. And he announced publicly that 70%, that's the figure I gave, that 70% of their funding was from narco-trafficking. And as I say, the Colombian government attributes 80% of the atrocities to them, and they're vicious atrocities. So yeah, it's pervasive at the high levels of government and right throughout the military. I mean, just last year, a Colombian Air Force plane was stopped for somebody investigated it for some reason in Florida, and they discovered drugs all over the place and impounded the plane, and a couple of high military officers ended up in jail. That was because it was a random inspection. But it's no secret that the military, the narco-traffickers, the landowners, and the government are all in bed together, and that the paramilitaries are part of it, exactly as they say. You pointed out correctly that part of the problem in Colombia is the consumption here, but that's what I'm talking about when I say that peasants seek to when peasants are driven to seek agro-export, which has a stable market, they are forced into drug production because there's a stable market, and the stable market is here. And if you want to deal with that aspect of the problem, which we should, there's a way to do it. The way to do it is by prevention, treatment, and elimination of the socioeconomic conditions that lead to it. That's here, and I ended up talking about that. You said that if we fail, last point, if we fail to help Colombia with real aid, it's going to increase the narco-trafficking problem carried out by the guerrillas. No, I don't think that's quite right. First of all, there's no question of real aid going. We're not giving constructive aid. For example, constructive aid would be the kind of aid that the guerrillas are asking for, and that the Colombian government, incidentally, is asking for. They agreed on this, namely some funding for alternative crops, okay, to allow peasants to produce something other than coca and still be able to survive. So that's being asked for by the FARC guerrillas and the Colombian government, and they're being told, sorry, no, you're going to get chemical and biological warfare and military gunships. OK? Okay? And yeah, that's going to contribute to exactly the same factors that drive people to narco-trafficking. If you make it impossible for peasants to survive, and when they produce the only thing they can produce in order to feed their children, and then you go after them with biological and chemical weapons and gunships, yeah, they're just going to go deeper into the Amazon or cross the border into Ecuador and produce more drugs. Yeah, and the narco-traffickers are going to gain by it, and the military will gain. That's more or less the same people, the landowners, who've taken over most of the small number of landowners who've taken over most of the wealth of the country. Yeah, they're going to gain. And yeah, there'll be more narco-trafficking. You're right. That's the result of the Colombia plan. Furthermore, it's understood. It is understood that these programs, including the background neoliberal programs that force peasants out of production for local needs, it is going to drive them to producing things like coca. Yeah, it's going to do that. And it's being done with eyes open, because they don't care. You know, if that's what happens, fine, as long as the internal injustice remains, as long as U.S. corporations get access to the wealth, free access to the wealth of the country, and as long as there's a way to criminalize the poor population here and get rid of them and frighten everyone else. Those goals are being achieved, and they're being pursued ever more intensively.
That was Noam Chomsky on U.S.-Colombia policy. He spoke at Roxbury Community College in Boston. Noam Chomsky, MIT professor, is internationally renowned for his critique of U.S. foreign policy and the media. Since its inception, AAR has made a special effort to archive the work of Professor Chomsky. We have perhaps the largest collection of audio cassettes in the world. Over the years, I've also done a series of interview books with him. The latest one is The Common Good. It is available from AR. To access our catalog, visit our website, www.alternativeradio.org. Again, website, www.alternativeradio.org. Or you can call our toll-free number, which I'll give you in just a moment. To place a Visa or MasterCard order for the complete one-hour program you just heard, Noam Chomsky on U.S.-Colombia Policy, and to order the book, The Common Good, call us toll-free, 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number for Visa or MasterCard orders is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can send in your check. Cassettes are 13, plus a dollar for postage. Printed transcripts are 9. The address, AR, P.O. Box 551, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Martin Folker recorded the program. AR's general manager is Joe Ritchie. Tanya Lowendorf is associate producer. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.